If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. Whether it's a sun and sea resort, a far-flung adventure, or just the simple pleasures of camping, nothing beats a good holiday. And we aren't the first to think so. In her book, Tourists, How the British Went Abroad to Find Themselves, Lucy Lethbridge looks at the emergence of mass British tourism in the 19th and 20th centuries. She told me more about early package holidays led by the fatherly Thomas Cook, vomit-inducing long-distance stagecoach journeys, and the hedonistic pleasures of continental health spas. Thank you so much for joining me, Lucy. Your book is called Tourists, and tourism has for a long time been seen as something quite different and distinct from the age-old practice of travel. So when did this idea of tourism emerge in Britain, and what set it apart from the travelling that had gone before?
I mean, oddly enough, I think it is actually has a longer lineage than that, because it is, in fact, the idea of the tourism part of the tour, is really in direct descent from the medieval pilgrimage, when people went in groups, small groups, to Constantinople or to Rome to see the relics of St. James in Santiago, for example, and then they would come back with a cockle shell, or certainly having built up some credit in heaven. And it was a lifetime's holiday, we would now call it, but with a very strong purpose. So I think in a sense that tourism actually does have that deep kind of collective memory of a purposeful tour. And of course, that was followed by the idea of the Grand Tour, which was made by young aristocrats who went to the great sites of classical Europe to burnish their classical education, and which was all the necessary accomplishments and knowledge that went with being a gentleman of leisure and an aristocrat.
So when did these forms of tourism expand and become accessible to more people?
Well, I've started my book in 1815, which is the year of the Battle of Waterloo, which ended the decades of the Napoleonic Wars, and which had closed off the continent to the British for nearly 20 years. There'd been a brief respite in 1802 with the Peace of Amiens, but that hadn't been very successful and the shutters were closed. And in 1815, the British hadn't seen France unless they were fighting there for two decades. So over they pour. And of course, there'd been enormous changes in that early part of the 19th century. So the sort of person who suddenly wanted to see the continent was very different from that grand tour aristocrat that I mentioned before. There's an expanding middle class. There's new steam packet travel. In a very short time, there will be railways. The first railway is 1831. So we're really getting into the industrial age, when travel is going to be made much easier and much more democratic, and really purchasable for anyone with enough money to take a train and take a steam packet and stay in a cheap hotel. Mm. And that really, I think, is the beginning of what we now think of as the kind of mass tourism which we have today.
And something I was really fascinated to learn in your book was that Brits abroad haven't always had the best reputation. And actually, that is quite a long-standing thing. Can you tell us about some of the caricatures or stereotypes about British tourists that you uncovered in the historical record?
Well, I think, to be fair, I don't know that the Brits abroad have a worse reputation than anyone else abroad. I mean, I think that you know, marauding groups of foreigners change local areas irrevocably. As long as they come in numbers, they are always viewed as bringing change, bringing, you know, difficulty, bringing roughness, bringing alcohol, all these things. I don't think the British are alone in that. But I think the British have a very distinct way of satirizing ourselves. So the British love nothing more than to transport their own class calibrations, their own sense of identity as being closely allied to class. And they take it abroad with them. And of course, when you're abroad, you see your own countrymen in a very particular way, in a sort of goldfish bowl, and you encounter people from home who you would never encounter in the normal course of events. I mean, that's the same today. You know, to go on a long train journey, you may sit next to someone of a type you'll never, ever meet in your working life or your social life. And that's part of the great charm of travel. It's part of the great mind expansion. But the Brits enjoy this particularly because it plays to our own delight in satirizing our own class types. And in the 19th century, there grows up a whole sort of school of hilarious caricatures of tourist types, you know, the fusspot invalid, the ridiculous gullible girl who is excited by everything foreign and all in a flutter, the terribly frightened lady who thinks that foreigners are all out to steal her purse. Then there's the kind of huge red-faced John Bull who refuses to eat foreign food. And these are all in a way highlighted by the tourist experience when British types themselves are thrown into proximity with other types. I mean, the accounts of going on a steam packet across the Channel, for example, when everyone was incredibly sick. And so you might have booked yourself a first-class cabin, but in the end, absolutely everyone on a bad crossing went up onto the deck. So you were throwing up with all types. And I think that it's that sort of slightly democratizing experience that makes our accounts of our own tourist adventures very particularly piquant, because it's really about our own particularly observable delight in class difference.
Mm. So in these early days of tourism in the 19th century, what were some of the most desirable destinations?
Well, my book concentrates on Europe. In fact, over the 19th century, people travelled all over the world. The novelist Trollope went round the world about twice. I mean, and he was, you know, he was not alone. People were incredibly adventurous, much more than we might imagine now. I mean, they went in for long haul travel. And when it really was long haul, when it took you, you know, days, weeks, months to get anywhere. But the popular tourist destinations, sort of group tourist destinations, the crowded places were similarly the places that they are now, but they were essentially laid out by the grand tourists. So they were Rome, Constantinople, Paris, of course, Venice, you know, the places of Italy, Naples, Vesuvius, Sicily. And then sometimes the Low Countries were also very popular, the Netherlands, Belgium, Brussels, Ghent, Bruges, and of course Germany, which remain one of the number one destinations for English tourists right up to the Second World War.
And I wonder if we could talk now about logistics. What were some of the practical challenges of going abroad in the 19th or perhaps the early 20th century? Things that we might not even think twice about today.
Before the trains, you would have had to, once you got off your steam packet or your channel crossing, probably feeling absolutely ghastly and having been sick the whole way. Once you stumbled onto the gangplank, there'd have been a huge amount of queuing and bureaucracy and customs. There was a lot of stamping of passports, a lot of checking of luggage to make sure you weren't bringing in contraband. And then you would have had to take a diligence from Calais, for example, to Paris. The diligence was a horse-drawn omnibus, a sort of stagecoach, but it was absolutely huge. It was the cheapest form of travel, so everyone was crammed in. And there were various classes. It was slightly cheaper to sit on top of the roof, but at the same time, it was vastly preferable to sitting inside because you were squashed in with other people. And the terrible smells, and if you could think people are being sick on the diligence, having just been sick on the boat, there was no air, you couldn't see out of the window. But chiefly the problem was that it went at about 3 miles per hour, and it changed horses every 6 or 7 hours. So it took about 3.5 days to go from Calais to Paris, and people talk of the misery of the diligence, and I must say, one can really feel how ghastly it was. I found a diary in the Bodleian that was written by a man on a diligence, and his handwriting is all over the place because it was obviously jolting all the way. You can imagine wooden wheels on a sort of cobbly, unmade road. And his handwriting is all over the place. And finally, he sort of signs off saying something, cannot go on too miserable. It was obviously simply the worst possible experience.
Mm. Some people that sprung up to help out with issues like this were, of course, travel agents. So when did travel agents emerge, and what kind of services did they offer in the early days?
There were people called things like vetrianos that you could appoint on the continent when you'd arrived, which would be paid guides. So you would find yourself a paid guide, and he would look after you for the whole journey. But in the with the age of trains, you get this the new idea, which is an all-inclusive trip, which is which we've lived with ever since, which is the model of the holiday by which everything is taken care of by an agent. And of course, the most famous of those, and among the first, not quite the first, but almost the first, was Thomas Cook. And he saw that the new railways of the 1850s were going to transform the lives of working people. And he was a great temperance campaigner. And in order, he thought, to stop working people from going to the pub on their holidays, he would introduce them to holidays that would expand their mind, distract, educate, and further the good of mankind altogether. And he saw that to do this, he had to help people by offering them an all-in deal. So he would give you your train ticket, your accommodation, probably your food all in, as well as a guided tour. And this was completely revolutionary. No one had ever experienced this before. So when he first took his all in tours in Britain, and then in the 1850s, he took a group to Paris.
And when you say he took a group, he literally took the group himself, is that right?
Yes, he took the group. He was a very sort of fatherly, I think rather stern figure, but utterly trustworthy and reliable. And so people who had never travelled before, particularly independent women, who he particularly also encouraged, they would give him their money, give him their lives, and he would look after them. And this was a completely revolutionary new form of travel. And people were meeting other people for the first time through this form of travel as well. So you get this idea that the holiday is removing you from familiarity and putting you in a completely new place with completely new people.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So I think the tourist in the 1950s wouldn't see a great deal of difference in their, you know, their trip to the continental beach holiday emporium in Sardinia than they would if they went to a similar one now.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does, or that silly thing you said in a meeting. maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It sounds terribly exciting. From all the diaries and the accounts that you found of people going on these expeditions, these holidays, was that the general sentiment? Were people just really excited to experience something different? Or did some people have concerns?
Well, I think there was certainly a feeling among the upper classes that their territory was being invaded. And I think, you know, that it's a feeling that happens now, isn't it? We all know what it's like when you hear from people that their favourite Greek island has been discovered, you know, after an article in the Sunday Times Travel. Everyone comes pouring in, and the original people who thought they were, you know, the very first to find it are in retreat and have to go and find another island that's even more private. I mean, this is the story, in a way, of tourism, and very particularly, I think, of British tourism, which is... It has a sort of paradoxical double edge. On the one hand, it's the search for privacy. I think it's a national characteristic that we are always looking for somewhere untrodden. We love the idea that we're having a small adventure somewhere where no one else has been. And on the other hand, we also make wherever we go into this Little Britain. You know, this sort of either a posh Little Britain, there are many Greek islands which are posh Little Britains, and then there are fish and chippy and, you know, sort of hermetically sealed sun and sea resorts. So you get this twin sense that the British are moving in groups and other British are running away from them at the same time. And there's a huge amount of snobbery about the cooks groups that sprung up. They were considered very middle class. They were sort of commercial travellers. They only had 2 weeks holiday a year. And the people of leisure, who didn't have to worry about any holidays at all because they didn't work, looked down on them. And they were often characterised, you know, with tremendously snobbish terms like herds, flocks, swarms, you know, these rather sort of dehumanising lumpen terms like animals.
Well, I think that point you raised there of holiday leave is an important one, isn't it? Because when did most working people get enough time off? And when was there a conception that you would use this leisure time to go on holiday?
Well, traditionally, the working man, the really working man, the manual working man, his holidays were entirely at the whim of his employer. And traditionally, they were holy days, holidays. They were feast days. So in holy feast days would be a day off when everyone would get together and make merry and not have to work. But as the Industrial Revolution got going, those were whittled away because more and more working people went into factories, and factories ran on much stricter lines. And, you know, owners of factories were less inclined to give time off. Time that used to be, you know, part of the agricultural cycle. And so in the 1870s, they introduced the first Bank Holiday Act, which meant that there were statutory bank holidays. But 2 weeks holiday a year, statutory paid holidays of any longer period, didn't come in until 1938. so just before the Second World War. And before then, you might have had 2 weeks off a year, but you had to pay for your own holiday because you weren't going to be paid over that period.
So quite transformative then for...
Totally. I mean, that's like nothing else.
One of the slightly less glamorous forms of holiday that you do discuss in the book is the rise of camping. What can you tell us about that and when it became a thing?
Well, camping is part of the late 19th century reaction to the Industrial Revolution. I mean, I come to the conclusion in the book, in fact, that the modern holiday, as we understand it, dates back to the mid-19th century, and it is all a reaction to the Industrial Revolution. All modern holidays are searches for pastoral Arcadias. There is a sort of collective yearning for something that is non-urban, that is untouched by modern life. And of course, by going there, we destroy it. But the camping holiday, I think, is very particular to that experience. In the end of the 19th century, you get this interest in bicycling, in outdoors life, in things like hiking for men and women, in exercise, in things that would certainly not have been fashionable 50 years before. And there's this desire, I think, to return to the land. You know, the early journals of the camping associations are always decorated with a pot over a fire, which is a very deep, I think, sort of Arcadian British yearning for a world that's lost. There's a great interest in travelling people, in Romany gypsies, for example. There's a whole new science grew up, or a sort of socio-science, called gypsyology, that became very popular in the 1880s, 1890s. People looking at the Romany gypsies, listening to their songs, interested in their history, is interested in the travelling experience. And that feeds from camping into caravanning, which I think is part of the same impulse, which is a very deep idea about the freedom of taking to the road. A moment when you are released from the petty tyranny of office life, of bureaucracy, of dreary, timetabled 9-to-5 work, and you are free.
And did you uncover any holidays that to modern tourists would seem strange or unusual? I know that one thing you mention is tourism to the Third Reich.
Yes, I don't think that would seem unusual to us, because I think tourism, if anything, has been seeking out even darker things recently. I think that, as is the case with all merchandised experience, you know, in the end, once the experience seems banal or familiar, you search out even more extreme forms. So I think that in the Third Reich, when the Nazis in particular were very keen to promote Germany as a place of new ideas and a kind of superior social management, they particularly marketed visits to Dachau, and they called it a labor camp for undesirables. And a lot of British tourists went on cycling tours, or went on walking tours, or just on group cook's tours to Germany, and came back having visited Dachau, seen the inmates, and thought that they were looking at a social experiment that they often thought seemed to make absolute sense and be extremely wholesome. So it is interesting the way these things are presented to us, and it's not always easy to see the rationale when you're there behind the presenting of that. But one could say the same about visiting Auschwitz now. Auschwitz, as you probably know, is now a UNESCO heritage site, but it's falling down. Should we rebuild it? These are very live issues about tourism, and I think that the seeking out of dark experience is a familiar theme throughout the 200 years until now.
Another theme that you unpick in the book is a connection between tourism and health. What can you tell us about that?
Well, a lot of travelling in the 19th century and early 20th century was done for health. People seeking changes of weather, or they were looking for water cures, going to spas, because, of course, people didn't know the causes of these very prevalent diseases like tuberculosis. It was very popular to go for long periods to spas, to hotels that had hydros, to take the waters. And all over the continent, there were these watering hole spots, which had had mineral waters for many years, that had been thought to have had health-giving properties since Roman times. And around them built this rather luxurious, often quite decadent societies, because people would live there for a long time. And they were often free of the gambling regulations that were in place in other parts, particularly of Germany. And so they were places where you could gamble. People thought they were dying often, so that they, you know, it was a bit like living your last days. People would, you know, they were famous for people having affairs. And, you know, they were considered very curious sort of worlds within worlds. And the cures were often terrifyingly extreme. You know, there were all sorts of theories about being wrapped in wet towels, hot water, boiling water, dousing yourself in these absolutely horrible springs where everyone doused. At Wiesbaden, there was a sort of scum on the water that obviously came from all the sweaty bodies that were bathing there. And it was called cream. And the authorities at Baden-Baden, rather than saying it was an absolutely disgusting health hazard in itself, marketed the cream as particularly health-giving, insisting that people drink it.
Oh dear, no thank you. So, Lucy, if you could jump in a time machine and partake in one of these journeys that you've documented in the book, are there any that really stand out to you that would be really fascinating to go on?
I'd like to have visited Majorca, I think, just before the real turning point in the early 30s, when it became a sort of sun and sea destination. I'd love to have gone there then, to seen the interior of Majorca before it was sold to huge mass touristic experience. And I've quite a yen to go on one of the gypsy caravan holidays that were very popular with the middle classes around the 1920s. And it was, you know, to hire a horse-drawn gypsy caravan for 2 weeks and set off down unpaved roads, getting your food from local farmers, and, you know, having a pot over a fire.
Yeah,
I think I buy that romance. Like it.
What do you think these earliest generations of tourists would think about holidays today?
Well, the modern sun holiday has been around since after the Second War, which after all is nearly 70 years now. So I think the tourist in the 1950s wouldn't see a great deal of difference in their, you know, their trip to the Pontinental beach holiday emporium in Sardinia than they would if they went to a similar one now. I think that they would be astounded by the interest in food. I mean, one of the things I was quite surprised about when I started researching this book is how little the Victorian tourist or the Edwardian tourist, or even right up until the 21st century, was interested in food. But that, of course, is a very abiding thing now. I mean, people, you know, food has made places a destination. And so it's kept alive all sorts of interesting local food products that I think would have long gone. The Victorians never mentioned food other than to wonder where you can get a good cup of tea and to say that the food isn't up to scratch. I mean, they very rarely will say, well, we want to go to this place in the Alps because they've heard that there is a particularly delicious cheese. And so that is a new modern holiday invention, which I think is interesting and will bring in its wake all sorts of local preservation, which I think is good.
That was Lucy Lethbridge. Her book, Tourists, How the British Went Abroad to Find Themselves, is out now, published by Bloomsbury. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.